please don't hang out in front or on the street smoking and, you know, just jawjacking after the meet. Please refrain from using any profanity. Other groups from the church meet here. Please show them some respect. I'd like to thank those that set up. Jeannie, Eddie, who else? Who set up? And Lou. Thank you so much. Now I need three volunteers to clean up. Mike.
And Chris.
And Andy. And you. Good, we got it. Thank you so much. All right? Yeah, Big Chris, you got it too. Good deal, man. We throw it out there. We'll help you out. We will not let anyone languish any longer. It's just not the deal. We'll get you involved right away. All right. And some of the things we study tonight go to odds with what many of us believed about AANA, staying clean and or sober in the 12 steps. This is not meant to be an indictment of anyone's program, but we'd like to ask that you please have an open mind on the subject material we cover tonight and be open to new experience in working the 12 steps. Well, Sharon, please keep your focus on recovery and your experience in working the steps. If you're not going through the work with an AANA member or have gone through the work with an AANA member, please refrain from sharing. Please say set-aside prayer. Who's got that?
Greg, I'm an alcoholic addict.
Hey, Greg.
Greg, Donna, we invite you into this room to guide and direct each of us as we seek your truth. Father, please set aside within each of us that which would block us off from the truth. Lay aside our prejudices and about what we think we know about this process, this meeting, and our spiritual condition. Remove our fears, Lord, that we may hear your truth through the members of this group. Give us the strength and courage to share your truth with each other in a real spirit of love and compassion for our fellow men. Amen. Amen. Amen.
Thanks, Greg. Before we begin, if we could all take a moment and let God quiet our minds from the thoughts of our day. This meeting runs an hour and 15 minutes and ends at approximately 8:45 AANA time. Because of limited time, please remember that after the presentation, part of sharing is sharing the time. And before I turn the meeting over to my good friend, Chris. Chris is just a really good friend of mine, helped me out a lot. If it wasn't for God putting me in the capable hands of Chris Chris turning me over to Ray, this meeting wouldn't be here tonight. It's really neat to see this group after 2 years, everybody here. It's unbelievable. It means a lot to me. I don't even know what to say when it comes to what's going on. It's just so cool to see people recover. I love watching people recover. I love watching people light up. And I love to see God work in others' lives. Bless you. You know, it's just an amazing thing. You know, and a part of the book in Dr. Bob's Nightmare, you know, he says if you go about recovery with one half the zeal of when you were out there using, you know, trying to get a drink, you'd be amazed. You know, and I'm amazed every day. Really amazed every day. And I'm just a blessed guy. You know, this is just really cool. I really thank everybody so much for coming. And I'd like to thank Freehold for the lovely fruit basket. I'm going to tell you this. What happened with me was I was about 15 months, 13 to 15 months sober and clean. And I was out of my mind, Shawnee. I was out of my mind. Sean, hey, what's up? You know, the Beeville contingent is here. And I was out of my mind. And I was dating this gal, the big unit. And the big unit guided me to Chris. Those of you that don't know the big unit, she's a 6'3" Texan, which made me look like a midget. And it was just kind of funny. But she knew I was jammed up, and she put me into Chris's care and got me to Ray. And Ray took me through to work real fast. You know, just the way we do it here, real quick, no waiting around. And he stayed on me, you know. He set a time for me to finish my amends, and I got them done, and I met that. And he stayed on my tail. You know, when I left his house that night in June of that year, a few years back, and he said to me, he says, "When are you going to start a meeting?" I said, "I'm not going to start any meeting." You know, I had no interest. You know, I didn't really want to help that many people, and I didn't want to be involved in too much anything. And he kept asking me every week when I'd see him, "When are you going to start a meeting?" And eventually I kind of caved in and started looking around. And I used to come to a meeting here on Wednesday nights years ago. There was a step meeting of another fellowship. And that one kind of caved in, disbanded. Hey, Pilo. And I just always liked this place. I learned how to read here. I played handball here as a kid. I went to school up the street. I stopped by and I asked the pastor here, and I had long hair and crap back then, and I wasn't real fond of shaving or any of that. And I walked in, and the pastor brought me in, and I asked him if we could have a meeting here, and he said, "I'd love to have you. I've been waiting for somebody to come along and bring a meeting here." And gave me a key. You know, gave me a key. And I said, "All right," and ran around and run around putting posters out, you know, like little flyers everywhere to drum up some interest. And I stacked the deck by getting the guys from Bernardsville and Bayonne and whatnot when Bayonne was around to come down here. And a lot of people helped out here. And this meeting really changed my life. It's helped me out more than I could ever tell you. More than I could ever tell you. I can't even describe what seeing you all here does. And seeing you all here recovering, seeing everybody happy, and seeing people get free. It's just wild, man. Absolutely wild. But Chris here is he's actually the only non-ANA member sanctioned by, I guess we'd say, the governing body to speak freely. Chris is the guy that Ray and I go to for guidance. Chris is a trustee of this fellowship. He's the only non-ANA member that's a trustee. And we go to him for guidance, and he usually gives us good guidance. He just got a lot of knowledge. He's got a pretty great story and a lot of experience working with others and just carrying this message and doing the work. And I'd like to turn this over to Chris. Here at Manasquan's second anniversary. Welcome everybody, and give it up to you, brother.
Thanks. Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. It is great to be here. This is a phenomenal meeting. I've been here before. I feel comfortable in this meeting. I feel like I don't need to hold anything back. I know the people in this meeting. I know you're probably more interested in truth than you are in manners. So I feel very comfortable here. My story is I'm what the book Alcoholics Anonymous describes as a real alcoholic. I went down the scale pretty far with my alcoholism. And when I was exposed to contemporary North Jersey Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, it was only partially successful for me in dealing with the things that needed to be dealt with. As far as my addictive illness is concerned, I know the people in this room have had the crap kicked out of them by addictive illness of one kind or another. That's usually why you end up in ANA, because contemporary recovery programs in certain areas aren't really designed to deal with the low bottom or the person who's really lost control over drugs and or alcohol. And that's just the way it is. I'm not going to cast a judgment on that. It's neither good nor bad. There are different meetings for different people. But I think it's a very, very good and very, very positive thing that ANA formed. There was a need, there was a niche for it. Absolutely. There's people that respond to this hands-on, get-busy type of recovery process. And if you're that type of person, then this is the place for you. I truly believe that. In three places in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, which is really the foundational work as far as 12-step recovery is concerned, that was the first that it was put together, and that's basically what over 200 12-step fellowships base their recovery process on. So it's the foundational work. There's all kinds of crazy 12-step fellowships out there. Former Edsel Owners Anonymous, Brothers-in-Law Anonymous are two of them. There's probably Tower Snipers Anonymous. I mean, you name it. Any kind of...
Monthly.
Yeah, they meet in tall buildings. Any type of obsessive compulsive disorder, any type of disorder where you're doing something that's causing you damage and you can't seem to stop doing it, that's what 12-step programs are for. 12-step programs get criticized all the time by a lot of different people. But I'll tell you what, rarely do they get criticized from people who've actually gone through the 12-step process and applied those steps and taken those steps in their life. The people that have done that have found the spiritual awakening as the result of the steps and are what I would term believers. They understand now. I want to talk just a minute about the scale of alcoholism, because some people may not understand that. In contemporary AA, you're told there's no such thing as an alcoholic's an alcoholic, or a drug addict's a drug addict. Being an alcoholic is like being pregnant. You're not a little bit alcoholic. And I think that kind of lip-flapping nonsense really misses the point, especially for people like us. We need to know the truth. Picture a very, very simple graph, a bar graph, that just goes up and down. All right? Up at the top is a high-bottom alcoholic or a high-bottom addict. Let's call that number 10. That's an individual with a real sufficient desire to stop or moderate whatever they're using, whether it's alcohol or drugs, can do it. They meet Mrs. Wonderful, and they calm down and they start a little family. Have you ever partied with people like that? When the time came, they grew up, right? Okay, that's way up at 10. Yes, they're drinking a lot, or they're using a lot of drugs. They're going out and they're partying. Sometimes they look just like you. Sometimes they close the bar with you. But when the time and the place comes, if a doctor says you're going to die, or a wife or a husband says they're going to leave, or a job says you're going to be out, or the cops say you're going to get urine tested, they can stop, moderate, or quit altogether without going to AA, and they're going to look, or NA or ANA, and they're going to look at you like you're weird if you do. What's your problem? I gave it up. Well, let me tell you, the 12-step fellowships have over 50% of the members of 12-step fellowships are up around number 10. They come into Alcoholics Anonymous, they don't work the steps, they don't sponsor, they go to one or two meetings a week, and you know what? They're fine and their life gets better. Is that your experience? No, it's not my experience either. I became more and more crazy going to 12 meetings a week. Without booze in my body. I was getting worse and worse emotionally. I was torn up emotionally. And you'd ask me, Chris, how you doing? Fine. Okay. Because you don't want to say, well, I was having thoughts today of killing myself. And, I was just trying to figure out how to do it. And I was wondering if jumping or gas would be better. How are you doing? That's not what you say to people. But that's what I was... So, as you go down the scale, you get to about a number 5. That's an individual who's either a drug addict or an alcoholic who has to go to meetings, who has to get a sponsor, who has to do service commitments, who has to make a lot of coffee, and has to be real consistent with their fellowship stuff. Has any of you been able to remain sober for a nice period of time, just being real active in the fellowship? There's probably some of you who had short periods of time where that was possible. Just going back to a lot of meetings and, you know, doing all that kind of stuff. The number five can do that and get away with it. They don't have to have a transformational spiritual awakening experience to be able to remain sober. Now, I'm not talking about whether they're happy or not. We all know the people who are just not drinking tea, and they're cranky about it. You know what I mean? And you know, they take it out on all the newcomers. You ever have them take it out on you when you're coming back? You know, those are cranky number fives or so, and they're just hanging on because they're really staying active. Now, as you get down toward the bottom, you find a lot of us. And what will happen with us is we'll go to a rehab, and then we'll start going to the 12-step, contemporary 12-step fellowships, and we won't make it very long. What will happen is we'll run out of steam. We'll say to ourselves, man, you know, this just isn't working. I mean, I don't feel any different. I'm going on, you know, whatever head trip you put yourself through, it just doesn't seem like you have enough power to stay really connected with the fellowship, really connected with the sponsor, really connected with service. You just don't seem to have the power. You just don't stay connected, and you just don't stay clean, and you just don't stay sober. Okay? Down around the ones and twos, here's what's needed. Consistency at the fellowship. Connecting with people with the same types of addictive illnesses. You have to have FaceTime with these people, and you have to be consistent with that. Then you have to grab a hold of a sponsor, and you have to work the steps. You don't get the option of going to step meetings and talking about the steps and sharing about the steps and philosophizing about the steps and reading about the steps and listening to tapes about the steps. You got to do the steps, which is different than a lot of contemporary 12-step fellowships. There's a lot of meetings that I went to for a very, very long period of time where people did not do amends. People did not sponsor. People did not meditate. People did not do a lot of the things that you're told to do in a 12-step program. And it's because they weren't ones or twos. They were sevens or eights, and they could get away with it. We can't get away with it. We need to know the truth about where we are. You know, where are we? We're in trouble. You know, so that's where we are. It's Custer's last stand, and there's more Indians coming over the mountain. And the only thing self-will is going to be able to allow you to do is get involved in the work. You have enough self-will to motivate you into consistency in meetings, getting a sponsor and going through the steps and doing the steps. The great thing about ANA is they bird dog you. They want to know how many amends you have left. They want to know how many weeks you've been writing on your fourth step. They want to know those things. You know what? Because it's more important to them to be supportive of a recovery process than it is whether you like them or not. They would much rather step on your feelings than step on your grave. How many 12-step programs have you gone to where they know they sure don't want to be real careful about hurting your feelings? Good God. You know what I mean? I was just out drinking 7 gallons of vodka a day, you know, waking up in Topeka with one shoe. You know what I mean? I've got liver damage. You know, God forbid you tell me the truth. It might hurt. You know? So anyway, consistency in meetings, going through the steps with the sponsor, and then sponsoring other people. It's a requirement. It's not an option. No, I don't think I would make a very good sponsor. Tough. Tough. You kill the first half dozen people you work with anyway. Get out there and get going. You know what I mean? Get it over with. Go to detoxes, rehabs. Go to the 12-step fellowships where there's not a lot of recovery stuff going on, and see if you can find some victims. Get busy. Let me tell you, if you want to learn something, teach it. Okay? If you're not really, you know, you're not really sure about the steps and this process, grab a hold of somebody and start teaching them. You will have to learn very, very quickly if you've got people that are dependent upon you. I'm only kidding about killing the first half dozen people. It's only about two or three.
Two or three.
Yeah. Get out there. Get out there. You want to know something? If you're a one or you're a two, and probably 80% of the people in this room are, you have two options. Live life along spiritual lines, which means the 12-step program is a suggested program of recovery. You've tried other programs of recovery, like yours, okay? The 12-step program of recovery is living along spiritual lines. Your only other option is to die an alcoholic death, die a substance abuse death, and you know we don't go out pretty. You know what I mean? We go out very, very pathetic. I do a lot of wet drunk work. I do a lot of grabbing people who are, you know, still soused out of their minds, just because I usually say yes to stuff like that. I have some experience. I know my limitations, and I know I'm not God. Sometimes I'm a messenger, sometimes I'm a taxi driver. But getting out there is very, very important. I get a call from my ex-wife, who divorced me when I needed her the most, back in 1982, okay? I was married for 12 of the happiest months of my life. And she saw shortcomings in me. I don't know where she found those. I thought it was real unrealistic to think that she wanted me to come home at night and, you know, get insurance on the car. Get off my back, I would say. You know, what's the matter with you? Weezer and Green Man want to go partying, you know? I'll be back in a couple days. And that didn't work. So she divorced me, as she should have, obviously. But I didn't know that until I did a four-column inventory and I got to column four. You know, column two was she left me when I needed her most. You know, column three was, you know, all these, damaged all these emotions and my, you know, my instincts and my ambitions. And she tramped all over my feelings and everything. And then I get to column four. I pulled a knife on her. You know what I mean? Why did she leave? I'm going to kill you! She left me when I needed her the most. Love. And I didn't see that until I did inventory. Because it's inconvenient for it to be my fault. You know what I mean? It's inconvenient for these problems in my life to be my fault. I don't want them to be my fault. They're my fault. I have to do something about it. Come on. I'm sensitive. Can't get involved in all that stuff. I think I'll get a therapist. You know? They can help me through all these issues. What I needed to do was I needed to do inventory. I needed to see what my part was, and I needed to make that right. And I did that many, many years ago. I made that right for my ex-wife. So when the time came that her brother ended up in the hospital 2,000 miles away from her, but conveniently 10 miles away from me, with congestive heart failure due to 40 years of drinking a quart of vodka a day... You know what congestive heart failure is like? I mean, you bloat up, your body can't get rid of any of the water, your heart is pumping about 2 beats a minute, you start to get, you're delirious, you're wandering around, walking like a duck. I mean, it's terrible. And I get a call, I get over there, and I visit with this guy. Now, you ask him, how you doing? Fine. You're dying. Buddy, you're dying, okay? I wouldn't bet $10 on you making it 6 months. I'm out there on the fire lines. I get to see the devastation and the destruction of alcoholism and the destruction of drug addiction. I can see the human deterioration that goes on with this illness. All right? But we don't want to push anybody into recovery too quick.
No, I can't do that.
That's fine if you're an 8 or a 9, okay? Go to an 8 or a 9 meeting where every once in a while they'll have you pick up chairs. Okay? Or you can be the cookie guy. You know what I mean? Well, what'd your sponsor tell you to do? Oh, my sponsor told me I'm in charge of the cookies. Okay, you're the cookie guy and your life is getting better, right? That's great. Where do we fit in? I mean, where do we go? We keep going in and out, in and out, in and out. And you know what they tell us? You're not being honest. You're not being honest. You don't want to really get clean. You don't want to really get sober. Let me tell you this. Would you go back and raise your hand and tell them, I'm coming back, humiliate yourself if you weren't serious about separating from whatever the hell is killing you? Of course you want to get away from it. And you keep going back and you keep wondering if it's you. And are you one of those constitutionally incapable of being honest people? Or, you know, let me tell you this. It's not that. It's the action that you get involved in. All right? Being the cookie guy ain't going to cut it for you. You need the whole Megillah. You need, like, Jimmy coming up to you and telling you, all right, I want you to do inventory, I want you to do this, and you're going to do this, and I want you here, and you're going to go freehold, you're going to be up. That's what you need if you're, like, a number one. Sorry. Maybe it's inconvenient, but your only other option is to just blot out from the consciousness of your mind the intolerable situation that you're being dragged through and hang in there till the bitter end when drugs or alcohol take you out. And I'm telling you, we go out in a very pathetic way. This guy that I'm 12-stepping has a suite in the Econo Lodge Motel on Route 46.
Styling.
The room is about a 10 by 10 and the housekeeping is not that great, let me tell you. I walk in there and the door blows open in the wind. The door won't shut. So we're sitting, I'm trying to 12-step this guy and the door keeps blowing open. They don't plow the... He's stuck in there and his entire family has written him off. His son and daughter showed up in the hospital to see him when he was in the hospital, all hooked up to wires and pumps and everything. They took one look at him, started crying, and got the hell out of there and never came back. And their mother was telling him, it's okay, you don't need to be exposed to that. He's doing it to himself. You don't need to feel the pain from that. Let's just not see it anymore. Let's not go back. So you know what? The only family this poor guy has is his sister's ex-husband from 24 years ago. That's the only person that's going to go visit him. That's how we go out, okay? That's how we go out in disgrace. Anybody in here want to go out in disgrace? I don't know about you, but if I've been running around and I'm the tornado running through everybody's life, I want to get clean, I want to get sober, and I want to set the scales right, okay? Because that's what's really inside me. I'm really not a bad person. The illness has caused me to isolate. The illness has caused me to push away anything that was getting in the way of my drinking or using. It has to go. And that's not even a conscious choice. You don't say to yourself, well, you know, going to the bar tonight, I have to give up my family. It doesn't work like that. But you know what? You give up your family to continue to drink. You give up your family to continue to use the drugs. That's how serious this is. None of us want to go out in disgrace. It doesn't take that much work, really, to work a recovery program. In ANA, you can get through the steps in a matter of weeks. And then there's the maintenance. Then there's 10, 11, and 12. And then there's a lot of 12-step work. And then there's renewing the steps every year or so. Go through the steps again. That's That's a small price to pay for not only survival, but for an improved quality of life. Because when we get into this room, our quality of life is pretty low. We may not really see that because we haven't known anything really different in quite a while. But I've got to tell you, here's what my quality of life was like in my last week of drinking. I was living at Mom's house. I was 32, living at Mom's, because, you know, she needed help. I had a little room upstairs. No, really, I'd have been homeless, you know. I'd have been under the bridge or in the Maytag box. I would have, but this woman would not throw me out. She just would not throw me out. So I'm upstairs in a room in my mother's house, and I was an electrician. I was a pretty bad one. I mean, I caused a lot of fires.
Sparky.
I'd get electrocuted just constantly. My hair was sticking up. They called me Ignatowski because I'd be like, "Oh, boss, I backed the truck into a fire hydrant again." You know, I mean, I was constantly doing stupid stuff. I'd have to be at work at 8. I'd come to at 10 of 8. Set the alarm clock for 10 of 8. I'd be wearing the clothes I was drinking in the night before. I'd get up to my feet. I'd stagger to the bathroom. I'd do my vomiting calisthenics. Anybody ever do like morning vomiting calisthenics? Wah! Wah! You know, smoking Pall Mall Reds, and then I'd brush my teeth. And sometimes I'd brush my teeth before I vomited because I'd be too confused because it's too much, all this waking up. And then I'd stagger out to my car, which was a 1976 Ford Granada with white walls, no clutch, no parking brake, no heater core. You turn on the heat, it would squirt antifreeze on the inside of the window. It had no muffler. It sounded like a bad inboard, outboard boat. And it was terrible. And quarter panels were all destroyed. And there was orange paint all over the interior from a blackout. I don't know how it got there. It was like somebody like threw a gallon of orange paint all around this car. It was awful, okay? It was a Quaalude car that you'd buy for about $5. I'd jump in this car and I'd drive the work. And if you would have pulled me over, if you were a cop and you would have pulled me over, I had been sleeping for 10 hours, but I would have blown a 4.7. I mean, that's how much I drank. I would have blown a 4.7. Yeah, my breath was flammable in the morning, but I was conscious because I'd been sleeping. I'd get to work and my boss would say, "All right, Chris, I want you this, 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 and this." I'd get halfway out the driveway and I'd go, "The hell did he tell me to do?" And I'd have to turn around, I'd have to come back and I'd say, "Yeah, ooh, what was that again? God damn it," he'd go. "I told you." I'd go off, I'd wire somebody's kitchen addition to a hot water timer meter, and it would come on at 8 o'clock at night and go off at 6 in the morning. Or I'd drill into somebody's closet and pull one of his suit coats up into the attic, you know. I mean, I'd do some kind of damage. I'll tell you, I'd be swearing to God I'm not going to drink. I'd feel terrible. You know those nuclear hangovers, your eyes are yellow, you're like, ah, you know, the slightest sound is like, oh, and I'm just shattered. A normal human being would be in the emergency room feeling half that bad, but we're used to it, you know. I work, you know, I'm a worker. So you stagger in just illing, you know, and you get in there, and I'm swearing to God, today's the day I quit drinking. I can't do this anymore. This is killing me. Today's the day. And if you'd have put me on a lie detector, I'd have been telling the truth. Today's the day. I'd have been telling the truth. Long about lunchtime would come, and I'd get a bag of chips down, or I'd buy a half a sub, and I'd eat like 2 bites. I mean, all of my calories were coming from alcohol at this point in time. And or every once in a while, I'd get really drunk, and I'd cook up an Elvis sandwich. You know what that is? That's like it's a pound of bacon and white bread. All right, that's what I would eat. You know, real health conscious guy I was. Anyway, I survived on that stuff. I swear to God, yeah. I was 125 pounds when I came into AA. A mean 125 pounds. You know, you wouldn't want to mess with me. Unbelievable. So here, I'd get a little bit of food in me, and that awful hangover would start to diminish a little bit. I'd hydrate up. I'd drink like a half a gallon of something. I'd hydrate up. This one time I used a half a gallon of grape drink, and sometimes you get sick. You know what I mean? When you're at work, you got to vomit. So now I'm working with this guy who hates me because I'm so lame all the time. I'm always confused and blowing him up by accident. So he's mad at me. He's mad at me. So I know I've got this down. I've got 14.6 seconds to get to a place where I can vomit in peace. So, and he's right there. So I know I'm going to tear around the back of the house. I tear around the back of this house we're working on. I stucco the back of this house with purple vomit, just like fire hydrant. Whole half a gallon of vodka came out in about 1.2 seconds. And I thought I was alone, right? Well, I look over and there's a deck adjoining the back of this guy's house with a family on it. There's a father, a mother, and three kids all having iced tea. And you could tell they were related because they all had the same look on their face. It was like this. The purple puke monster from hell, Daddy! And being an alcoholic, you have to act cool, right? So I'm getting out the hose. Yeah, I always wash the house down when I do this. Yeah. Nervous condition I have. Well, now, that really firm decision I made earlier in the morning about never drinking again, I start to think I might have overreacted toward the middle of the afternoon. I might be taking a little too strong of a position on this. As a matter of fact, maybe I'll have to stop at the liquor store on the way home because I am feeling a little better. I'm going to stop at the liquor store on the way home. And blah, blah, blah. You know, if there's any of this quitting stuff to be done, it'll have to be over the weekend. So here's what happened. I am sane in the morning. I know the truth from the false. I know alcohol is killing me. I know it. I start to become insane. The obsession of the mind starts to take over. As the day goes by, I am without defense against buying that bottle of vodka that near killed me, embarrassed the hell out of me, and discolored the back of somebody's house. I'm incapable of making a decision to separate from that. I can't. That's the obsession of the mind. Let me tell you, the first step, people in this room, I believe, understand the first step. There are people, though, with 20 years in AA that haven't the slightest clue about what the first step is. They'll say things like, I just don't drink today no matter what. Even if my ass falls off, I drag it to a meeting. I don't know about you guys, but 2 weeks prior to my ass falling off, I'm drinking. That's just the way it is. I'm not going through the ass falling off thing without some booze. So people that say that type of stuff have no clue. The first step isn't, I can't drink. No matter what, I just don't pick up a drink. That's not the first step. The first step is you have an obsession in the mind that will force you back to drinking and or drugs, whatever your drug or substance of no choice is. You have a mind that will take you back there, and that's going to happen. Without divine intervention. Divine intervention. God shining down from the clouds on you. If that doesn't happen, you're going back to booze and alcohol. And if you get that message in a rehab, they usually hand you a bill for $12,000 right after that.
And a big book.
And a big book. Once you start drinking and start using, you have a body that will continue to engage you in that activity. If it's alcohol, the phenomenon of craving is one drink asks for the second demands the third insists on the fourth, and you're knee-walking, tongue-chewing, zipper malfunctioning drunk. And that's just the way it is every single time. You're stuck. When I relapsed the last time, I had been sober for almost 90 days, and I was serious about this not drinking stuff. But I wasn't going through the steps with anybody. So here's how the obsession of the mind got me. And I'm telling you, there wasn't a person in the meetings who wanted to stay separated from alcohol more than me. I was desperate. So don't give me this, I wasn't being honest, or I didn't really want it. I really, really wanted it. Here's how the obsession of the mind worked for me. Man, I don't really even remember what it's like to really be drunk. It's been so long since I've had alcohol. And you know, this recovery process, I bet you I could do a better job at it if I really remembered what the alcohol's like. So I know what I'll do. I'll buy a gallon of vodka. I'll take it home. I'll drink it. And that'll help me with this AA stuff. So I bought a gallon of vodka and drank it to improve my recovery. That's how the obsession of the mind had to get to me. Because I didn't want to drink. Obsession of the mind doesn't care if you don't want to drink. I thought AA was all about being a pep rally for, yay, yay, we don't drink today. Yay, yay, we don't drink today. Like, a meeting is like a football huddle. You know, you huddle in, you say, all right, you know, we're going to do a day at a time. You know, we're going to keep it simple. First things first, all right, break. You know? I'll see you back here tomorrow. It's a pep rally. And if I continue to get reminded I don't want to drink, everything will be fine. That does not help a real alcoholic or a real drug addict. We're without defense, without any mental defense against the first drink or the first drug. It has to come from a power greater than ourselves. Not the best news in the world. Not the best news in the world. Who among us wants to hear, buddy, you got to find God? Oh, no! Anything but that! I'm going to have to be with the rollers! Anything but the rollers! You know?
I hated them.
The rollers! They'd come over my house at 8 o'clock Sunday morning to talk to me about the Watchtower. Oh! Nobody wants to hear that. Nobody wants to hear the only solution is divine intervention, a relationship with a God of your understanding, a spiritual awakening that opens the door to a personal relationship with God. Nobody wants to hear that. That's bad news, because we've got prejudices and we've got preconceived notions about religion and about spirituality and about God, and we don't think it will work for us. That's okay for you. I'm in real trouble then, if that's the truth. We don't believe it'll work for us. The good thing about A&A is, before you even have time to have that discussion, they're involving you in a recovery process that's going to bring about the relationship with God. You'll get it despite yourself. Despite not wanting it, sometimes you'll get it. How many people in here have done enough step work to all of a sudden feel the grace of God shining in their life? How many people? You know it. You know what I'm talking about. It's an experience. You can't learn it intellectually. It's an experiential knowledge and understanding. I love to read books. I'm a reader. You know, and I like self-help books. You walked into my house when I had like 2 years sober, and there was a library of self-help books. You know, how to be this, how to do that, how to be better at this, how to feel better, how to do it, blah, 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 all these self-help books. I was looking for some kind of answer. The alcoholic or the drug addict is a person with a hole in their soul. They're seeking, without even their understanding, they're seeking a relationship with God. You are trying to find it in the dope. You're trying to find it in the pipe. You're trying to find it in the bottle. You're trying to find that Satori. It's a concept of being at one with yourself and the universe. You know what I'm talking about. You've probably even been there. The right combination, you know, the right combination of drugs and alcohol, and then, oops, you've allowed yourself to be overserved, and you're a puking pig. You know what I mean? That is what we're searching for. Why isn't normal sobriety enough for us? Why do we have to go over the edge? Why do we have to continue to use substances to make ourselves feel okay? What's wrong with us anyway? You know, Aunt Fanny doesn't drink 17 bottles of vodka over Christmas vacation. You know, Uncle Fudd doesn't rob his mother's diamond rings to buy more crack. You know, what is wrong with us? Why are we doing that? And that's what our families are asking too. What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? And we don't even understand the question. Because our condition is an addictive condition. We can't even see the truth for the false. We don't want to be the way we are. So we're searching for a connection, some kind of connection that's going to make us feel okay. I sit before you tonight with an awakened spirit. I've not only gone through the steps, I've gone through the steps many, many times. I've finished many a men's list. I live in 10, 11, 12. I do a lot of I'm very, very busy. Jimmy and there's a number of people in here who know me. They know I'm busy. I'm about my Father's business. That grants me what I've been looking for my whole life, which is a spiritual connection, a connection with the universe, a comfort, and an ease and a comfort within my... Have a hit? I'm good. You know, have a drink? No, man, I'm fine. It's not even something I contemplate. I don't think about it. I don't obsess about it. I don't wish I could. That stuff's been removed. It's been removed. And I'm okay. I'm more than okay. My quality of life is out the roof. It's in the stratosphere. Is it worth it participating in the recovery process? Absolutely. Absolutely. Our biggest problems facing us as we move toward getting really engaged in the recovery process is our preconceived notions. Bill Wilson didn't put that thing by Herbert Spencer in the Big Book by accident. The only thing that will keep us in everlasting ignorance is contempt without investigation. We ask you to investigate. I'll give you a for instance. Contemporary 12-step recovery programs and fellowships are filled with people that share their opinions. They don't share experience. I really try to keep it to my experience. So do you all in here. I'm preaching to the choir, but I'll give you an example of someone who will be sharing an opinion. Have you ever been in a meeting, say a step meeting, where somebody, it's the ninth step, and somebody raises their hand and says something like, I haven't done this step formally yet, but... And then they take the meeting hostage for 5 minutes, giving you an opinion on what they think the step might be about, without ever even experiencing the step. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. Now, would you rather hear that knucklehead, or would you rather hear somebody raise their hand and say, I've just come back from L.A. where I flew out to make 6 amends. I was able to make 5 of them. I'd like to just talk about that experience for a second. I want to hear about the experience. It's the experience that's going to save my life, not some muttonhead's opinion. I'm not interested in some muttonhead's opinion. I'm not interested in somebody's opinion who has not gone through the steps to talk to me about the recovery process. I'll give you another example from myself. I do a lot of speaking. You know, I say yes a lot. I don't think it's that I know more or am better than anybody. I get a lot of opportunities to speak. And I'm asked to speak at some colleges because they have MSW programs where they actually have alcoholism counseling courses. And they're about to send people out into the world to be therapists and clinical psychologists. And I get to be brought into some of these classes to talk about spiritual recovery. Because you can go all the way through, you can do 6-7 years of college and there's no course on spiritual recovery or 12 steps. It's the most significant event to ever hit addictive illness. You'd think there'd be a chapter on it. You know what I mean? They talk about everything else. They talk about how the brain synapses connect. You know, when you know the crack addict has one little chromosome up here that's just a little different. You know, and the brain works. Who cares? Who cares? You know what I mean? Good God! Who cares about that stuff? So I get to go in there and talk about spiritual recovery. So I use my own experience, and then I go through the steps. And I tell them what the spiritual awakening is about and the transformational process that you experience when you engage in it. And I did this one time, and everybody's looking at me, and they're taking notes, like, they've never heard this stuff before. They're about to be your counselors in 5 minutes. You know what I mean? You're about to pay them $85 an hour. And they're taking notes, listening to me, like they've never heard this stuff before. But don't worry. Okay. This guy follows me out of the room, and he says, I heard everything you said. I heard it. But don't you have to deal with remorse and shame? I go, no. And he goes, what do you mean? I go, let me ask you a question. Have you ever inventoried all the people that you have harmed through the 12-step process? No. I go, well, then you probably couldn't have shared that with another individual, yourself and God. No. Well, then you probably haven't become willing to have God remove the defects of character that caused the things that brought about your shame and remorse. No. And you never got down on your knees and humbly asked God to remove those shortcomings. I guess you've never done that. And he goes, no. And I guess, well, then you've never listed these people in these institutions that you've harmed and became willing to go out and make amends to them. I guess you haven't done that. And he goes, no. And I go, well, that means you probably didn't go out and actually make direct amends to these people in these institutions that are causing you the shame, the events that cause the shame. He goes, no. I go, then how the hell do you know whether you have to deal with shame and remorse? How do you know? You're giving me an opinion on an experience that you're trying to think instead of have. I don't deal with remorse and guilt and shame. I've done all my amends. I can hold my head up anywhere. I can walk down any street, okay? To the best of my ability, I've set right the wrongs. I've paid back the money. I've told people where I was wrong. I've made living amends to a lot of people, like my ex-wife who's sending me her brother. You know what I mean? I've done these things. I don't deal with shame and guilt and remorse anymore. Now, is my life perfect? No. But again, that's an example of someone with an opinion on an experience he didn't have. There's going to be people who say, you're one of those people in one of those meetings. You ever get that yet? You're one of those people in those meetings. Well, what do you mean by that? Well, you know, you're like really extreme. You're like Nazis over there. Well, what do you really mean by that? Well, you know, you've got that real extreme, real different, real weird way of working at a recovery program. You mean the way they designed it in 1938? That every single 12-step fellowship in the world is based on? Do you mean that one? Yeah. See, you know, you're going to have to deal with that. Never. It says we never apologize for trusting our God. What I think that means is we never apologize for the recovery process that's putting us in front of that which is keeping us clean and sober. We're never to apologize for that. Does that mean that we need to go into AA and NA fellowships around here and beat everybody up and tell them they're doing it wrong? No. Yes. You wait until they leave the meeting and you grab them outside and you tell them. But sometimes you get more flies with honey, you know, than you do with vinegar. Use your intuition, because I'm telling you, if you go through the steps, you're going to be in touch with that intuitive part of your nature that will tell you right from wrong. Start to use that intuition. You'll get the feeling, maybe I should do this or maybe I shouldn't do that. Try to start trusting that, because I believe that's how God communicates with us. That's one way. He communicates to us through our intuition, through that sixth sense, that realm of the spirit that allows us to get guidance from on high. Start to develop that. You'll see it work best in 12-step work. You'll see it work best when you work with people. You're not smart enough to help this guy get sober, you know? And all of a sudden he's sober. Wow! Look what I did. That wasn't you. It was you as a channel. You're a channel. The power is flowing through you. You're becoming an avatar of the power. That's really what goes on in these rooms.
And as we become channelers of the power of God, the fellowship that you crave will be created around you. Jimmy can tell you a little bit about creating the fellowship you crave. I can tell you a little bit about it. There's people from Burnsville, there's people from Freehold, there's people from Massillon, there's people from all over the place who can tell you about creating the fellowship that you crave. It's something that comes about when you tell the truth, you talk about the solution, the recovery solution, you're not afraid to talk about God, and you're out there helping others. You do that, and they will come. That's all I have. Thanks.
Great. I love this guy. Great. I love this guy. I'll tell you, man. Chris has helped me out a number of times. You know, especially in recovery when I'm insane.
We got you to stop wearing guns to meetings.
Yeah. I used to carry a gun to Chris's meeting every week, you know. But it's just...
just in case, you know, we...
He gets me to go to this retreat at the Wilson House. And then 3 months later gets me to go to a retreat at some convent. And I'm packing. You know, I got 3 guns. Oh, I don't know what they're going to do. You know? Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to be locked up with a bunch of alkies. Get out of here. You know? Get away. But it's just nuts. I want to open it up just for a couple minutes. Anybody got a question or anything like that? Anybody want to ask Chris anything? Or say something?
Speaking about that convent, this guy was telling me about his bottom the other day. He ran over a nun with his motorcycle, and he goes back to the bar. He goes, "How big's a penguin?"
Don't let help for that one.
All right, we got cake, and we got a real nice fruit basket there from Freehold. I really want to thank everybody for coming. I really like to thank God for just doing so many things in my life and so many things for other people. And if you're in this room and you haven't gone through the work, I strongly suggest that you grab somebody tonight and get through the work, because you have absolutely no idea how much trouble you are in. Your mind's telling you you're okay, and you're just a sick, sick guy or gal. And I'll tell you. You know, because I've been there. Chris saw me when I was really sick.
Ooh.
You know? I came walking into his meeting, and it was like the chairs parted like the Red Sea. Get away from that guy. Nobody would sit near me at meetings for like a year. You know? I used to go to the Lighthouse in Seeger when it was upstairs. They had a beginner's meeting. You've been there, right, Mike? It's like this little tiny room, like 10 chairs. It was me, 2 other people. Everybody else stood out in the hall. You know, like, no, don't sit near them, you know. And it's just amazing what being willing to do this work and going out and doing it and grabbing another man or another woman and having God allow you to take that time. When God allows you to be that paramedic and patch that person up for a moment, you know, bandage him up a little bit and get him to God, because God's the surgeon. He's going to do the big work. You know, you have a moment in time with that person, and it's a wonderful thing. It's a blessing, and it's an honor to sit down with someone else. I want to thank everybody for coming, and we got a great way of closing. Hey, you're okay. Nah, it was good. Mike, take us out.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Great.
Thank you for being here.
My mission is in.